Case number 22-1485, Jaquetta Coopwood versus Wayne County, Michigan et al. Court ordering is not to exceed 15 minutes per side. Mr. Hernandez, you may proceed to your counsel.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Felipe Hernandez, and I represent the plaintiff appellant, Jaquetta Coopwood. I can reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. Administrative remedies were not available to Ms. Coopwood at 6 months pregnant when she was jailed and kicked in the stomach, was experiencing cognitive impairments as a result of her mental illness. The PLRA only requires prisoners to exhaust remedies that are available. As the Supreme Court held in Ross versus Blake, the availability exception has real content and requires courts to consider whether remedies were obtainable or accessible in the litigant's situation. Dictionary definitions make clear that availability can be determined by reference to a particular context and to a particular user. Defendants do not contest Ms. Coopwood's mental health issues or her cognitive impairments. Instead, they say that she is arguing for a blanket mental health exception, but she is not. She is arguing that through no fault of her own, she was unable to navigate the grievance process, rendering remedies unavailable. The district court was wrong to conclude otherwise. Ms. Coopwood requests that this court reverse the district court's grant of summary judgment on exhaustion and remand the case on the merits.
It seems to me like a pretty straightforward argument that she exhausted. She's kicked in the stomach. She complains to anyone she can find. She says she fills out a form. She says she complains to other individuals. And this is all like temporally very close to the time for the action. And then, so it's within the 10 days. And then sort of just made the point that the facility does nothing, knows she has a disability, does nothing to help her, which is part of her policy. So it feels like she did what she could to exhaust, and the facility didn't do what it was required to do upon receiving those complaints, especially in light of her disability.
That's right, Your Honor. Well, we don't know what happened to the complaint. All we know is that she requested one after multiple attempts, and we don't know whether she was given the proper form. We also don't know whether she wrote a complaint that was unintelligible due to her mental illness, due to her cognitive impairments. We don't know if the defendants actually filed that grievance. All they submitted was a declaration from Director Crawford saying that there's no grievance on file. But she did attempt to ask for help reasonably after she was kicked, and we're not arguing that she was so psychotic or insane that she could not ask for help or try to write. Whatever happened to that form is a disputed fact, and whether a reasonable inference could be made that if she did not properly write her grievance, that goes to the first argument, or if she did not, or if she did file it properly, or it was not submitted properly, that goes as to our second argument as authority.
Well, so under our standard, we sort of accept what you're saying and then require the defendants to prove that you're wrong.
That's right. Right.
It's a relatively favorable standard to your client.
That's
so
right.
They have to show that your client didn't do these things. In my mind, doesn't feel like they did very much to show that your client didn't do these things. I mean, they didn't, for example, have all of the guards testify that your client never told them about the kicking or other complaints, right?
That's right, Your Honor. In Lambert v. Kendrick, this court clarified that once a plaintiff raises once defendants raise their affirmative defense of exhaustion, and the plaintiff says that they were prevented from doing so, it is defendant's burden to prove the negative here. Defendant's burden to prove that administrative remedies were available and that she did not grieve. They must submit indisputable evidence at summary judgment, and that did not happen in this case. And Your Honor, turning into towards our first argument, again, Ross versus Blake requires courts to look at, in her situation, in the litigant's situation, whether remedies were available. And here, we can make the reasonable inference that given her well-documented history of mental illness, that she had severe cognitive impairments and she was unable to grieve during the 10-day exhaustion window. Again, defendants did not submit evidence showing otherwise. On the contrary, the evidence that they did submit shows that she has debilitating mental illness and impairments.
Well, you said this is your first argument. Why isn't your first argument what I just laid out, which is she exhausted? She did all the things she was supposed to do, and they haven't shown that she didn't do it.
Well, that's
it makes
right.
sense when you're kicked in the stomach and you're pregnant and you complain about someone to that, you want medical care. And the facility did nothing to help her or pursue her complaints.
Well, you're
right. I mean, that's like your first argument. That's a pretty compelling argument.
Certainly, this court could rule on the second argument and find a defendant.
Well, why is it the second argument? the first argument is exhausted, the second argument is didn't exhaust it. He wants to interpret the statute in a way that's a little inconsistent maybe with our last decision. So your first argument would be she exhausted. The second argument is if she didn't exhaust, there's reasons, there's justification why I need to read the statute in a certain way.
Well, both arguments are meritorious, and this court could go in either direction, and we believe that both arguments would ultimately rule in this Scootoo's favor. As to the availability analysis, this is an issue that this court hasn't addressed yet. However, it has shown the approach that it can adopt stemming from Ross versus Blake as to availability. In Doe's verses 8 through 10, for example, this court looked at the particular individual circumstances that John Doe's 8, 9, and 10 encountered, the barriers are encountered in their attempts to grieve. And here, the district court found that though there are some capacities that could render remedies unavailable, it was difficult to draw the line, and it ruled on that basis. And therefore, we are arguing that the district court erred on that fact as a matter of law, as a matter of fact. It did not conduct the fact-specific inquiry in this case.
Sounds almost like you got caught whipsawed by a change of district court judges in the course of this case, didn't you?
That's right, Your Honor.
It sounded like Judge Tarnow was sort of leaning toward your position, and he dies on you. Then Judge Roberts takes over, and she switches gears. That's sort of what happened here.
Yes, Your Honor, due to unfortunate circumstances there. Still, the district court did acknowledge the availability as an exception in terms of looking at the individual circumstances, but it did not. It said it's difficult to draw the line, but that's exactly its mandate, that's a requirement in this case. And that's what we're arguing in this case. The district court was required to look at how her mental illness impaired her cognitive abilities and how that rendered remedies unavailable.
And what evidence in the record do we look at? Just the fact that she has a long history of mental illness?
Well, we can look at several time points. One, 3 days before she entered the jail, she was taken off of her medications, and she committed her underlying offense under a state of psychosis. She was not put on her medication until weeks after.
She stabs her mother to death.
Yes, Your Honor. And she does not recall that happening. When she's asked about it, she does not remember the event. She does not know what happened. So that is a reasonable inference that 3 days before entering the jail, she would have continued to experience those debilitating symptoms of schizophrenia and bipolar disorder.
And the prison was well aware of these conditions, right?
Well, their records are internally inconsistent. They did have access to her records going back to 2012. There is no, it's unknown what they did with that other than placing her in the psychiatric unit.
Well, that would suggest they thought she had a psychiatric issue.
Yes.
Their policy speaks to this. So if you are unable to complete a grievance because of a documented disability, you may request assistance. It feels to me that she complied with that part of the policy, and the facility didn't follow its obligation to help her out.
That's right, Your Honor. They did not follow the obligation to help there. They did not meet their burden in showing that they went to the extent of following their own guidelines and their policy. So she did everything she could given her in her mental state. And Your Honor, again, going back to our first argument, other four circuits have also adopted this understanding of the availability analysis and looking at the particular capabilities of the litigant and their situation. And in all of those cases, though they deal with different circumstances, each litigant is facing different barriers, the method and the approach is the same, and that's the approach that Ms. Cooper is asking this court to adopt. That in looking at whether remedies are available, this court should look at whether in the litigant situation, in their particular context, and their particular situation, whether remedies are available, here they were not. And as Judge Wheeler pointed out, defendants have not met their burden. They have not shown that, submitted indisputable evidence that remedies were available and that she failed to grieve. In fact, given her state, she did everything that she could, and defendants have not shown otherwise.
What do we do with Williams versus White? How does that reconcile with what you call your first argument? I think it's your second argument, but what you call your first argument?
Your Honor, Williams is a non-binding, unpublished case, so this court is not bound by it. However, in that case, it's also not instructive. And there, in this court, in a single sentence, summarily dismissed that there is no mental capacity exception. There, the plaintiff specifically asked for a mental capacity exception. So that case has no bearing here. Ms. Cooper is not arguing for a mental capacity exception. She's arguing for this court to apply the textual exception to exhaustion and availability, found in the availability analysis. And this court also has...
Disability is always equal to unavailability?
No, Your Honor. It's a fact-specific inquiry. We can imagine situations where a litigant may have mental illness, but they're able to, their cognitive functions are not impaired, but they can complete the grievance process. Or another situation, which does not happen here, a litigant has severe mental illness, and the jail accommodates their mental illness and helps them grieve in accordance to their policy. That also did not happen here.
I guess the, I don't want to take up all your time, but I guess the question I have is the three exceptions that have been recognized, I'll really focus on the prison, what the prison has done. The prison is foiled, whether the prison has made things, opportunities available, whether the prison has a policy that someone can understand. It really focuses on the prison. You want us to really focus on the prisoner.
The sort of
more subjective analysis where the test feels very objective, sort of what did the prison do, not what do we think about the individual prisoner.
A few points, Your Honor. First, all courts who have considered the Ross's three exceptions or three circumstances have found that they're not exhaustive. So this court is not limited by those circumstances. And it had Ross.
But that runs into our Williams point that there's no disability exception. It feels like you're asking for a fourth one, which would be a disability exception.
Your Honor, we're asking this court to apply Ross's definition of availability and saying that it requires analyzing whether someone in the litigant situation, whether it's in Blake's situation as a quote, was able to exhaust the remedies. So it does look as to the subjective position of the prisoner in that case. And in Ross, what was relevant were the defendant's behavior. And that is also relevant, and that goes to
Was the grievance procedure unavailable the entire time that Ms. Cook was in custody, or just a specific period of time?
It was unavailable during that 10-day period, and nothing suggests defendants do not allow for an untimely grievance, so she was only limited to that 10-day period.
So if something else came up and there was an issue to grieve, maybe in October of 2017, would you say it would have been unavailable to her during that time period as well?
After she received her antipsychotic medication, that would be a different case, and there the district court would have to draw a different line and looking as to whether the evidence showed that based on receiving her antipsychotic medication, her cognitive functions improved. We do have that in the record that Dr. Haddad noted that she was so incompetent without this medication, she could not make decisions about her own pregnancy. And even said she has intellectual disabilities based on her mental illness. She was psychotic for an unknown period of time. That included the 10-day window. I see my time is up, Your Honor.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Davide Stella, and I'm here representing Wayne County and Deputy Joni Watts. Your Honors, I heard the questioning, initial question, and we need to point out that this case has been a moving target, right? So in the first round of briefing, right, Ms. Cooplett had argued that she had tried on some unspecified days, unspecified times, unspecified individuals to try to file grievances and thought she had filed them, right? But after Judge Tarnow issues a supplemental order, she argues exactly the opposite. She said, I didn't file a grievance, and the reason why I didn't file a grievance is because of my mental capacity. So at a certain point, it's really, you know, and Judge Roberts recognizes this. So you can't flip-flop and say, well, when it suits me to say that I tried to file a grievance, even though the jail has no record that she tried, you know, that's one thing. But when Judge Tarnow invites you to make some other argument that you hadn't made, you know, okay, now it's fine for me to say I didn't file a grievance. So I really think that, you know, we should not accept the premise that her story all along has been that she tried.
Why isn't her story that she was under stress, she just been kicked, she told people, she asked for medical help, she thought that was filing a grievance, but if you don't think that's enough, then she has other explanations for why it didn't happen. This is a difficult situation for her. There's a lot going on, and why couldn't it be sort of, I think I did everything I had to do, but if you're saying I didn't do it, there was an explanation for why.
Well, I understand that, Your Honor. I'm just saying that it's difficult to argue to fight a different case on appeal than it was before the district court. So when Judge Roberts resolves this, she has five bases, you know, and it's in our brief, right? She says five points. She addresses the ultimate arguments that were pressed, right? And if we look at this case just from the perspective of what was actually raised in the district court and actually litigated, instead of, you know, new attorneys taking a fresh look at everything and making a new case that was not presented below, you know, I think it's just a little bit unfair for us to have to, you know, deal with changing positions and changing priorities. So, you know, the initial case, Ms. Kubla got an 8-month extension to file in response to our motion. I didn't oppose that. People went as long as they wanted. It was during COVID. Ms. Kubla's attorneys didn't get her medical records, didn't hire an expert, you know, did almost nothing except for just have her submit a short affidavit, right? So the idea is that now we're here on appeal and now we're arguing, well, the medical records of this, the medical records of that. We are the ones that submitted the medical records, you know. Ms. Kubla did not. Ms. Kubla, everything she says about anything the medical records say is all new on appeal. None of it was presented to the district court. So the idea is that, you know, when Ms. Kubla says, I have this documented long-term disability, where does that come from in the record? So the jail contracts all its medical services out to an organization called WellPath, which is one of these private medical organizations. So the jail, the Wayne County Sheriff's Office, doesn't provide medical treatment. It is completely 100% contracted out. So when Ms. Kubla comes in, she gets evaluated by WellPath, right? And all the sheriff's office knows about Ms. Kubla would be coming from WellPath. And WellPath, on her initial screening of her, did not think that she was in any psychotic state. And that's the day after she came into the jail on August 17th, which is the same day that she alleges a Sergeant Watt, who of course Wayne County doesn't employ anybody.
How much did she put in the psychiatric unit?
She was recommended, but that, I mean, that's, you know, a lot of people are in the psychiatric unit, and the people in that unit range from...
going back to your earlier point, I agree with you. It feels like this case has developed into something where the other friends on their side wants to make a wide sweeping pronouncement that will have major changes, and in some ways, we can focus on the facts of this case and perhaps decide it under our current law without reaching a broader issue. But on that first issue, why wasn't it enough for her when she gets in and she's kicked in the stomach and she complains to the officers, she's in the psychiatric unit? Why isn't that enough to satisfy her obligation under the policy to make a complaint?
Okay, Your Honor, I appreciate that point. If this case, if Ms. Kubla had gone all in on that argument in this case and stuck with it and said, well, I tried, some deputy who I don't know their exact name kicked me in the stomach while I was pregnant and dragged me across the street, and I tried, and no one helped me. If that had been the story all along, yes, that might go to a bench. That would be a bench trial issue, perhaps, in front of this report. We would say that we have a robust grievance policy. We get hundreds of grievances a month. We have every single one in the computer. We don't have hers, right? So, you know, let Judge Roberts...
Can't you make a verbal grievance if you're disabled? In other words, you're talking about paper. You're talking about filed, but you have an exception for verbal grievances if the person's disabled. You have to help them make the complaint.
The jail policy does not technically allow a verbal grievance, but it says that if you have a disability or you can't speak English, we will help you file one. And so we have actually people in the jail and social work.
She's saying that help, and how do you, it's your obligation to show you that you did help. And what's the evidence that you did?
Well, it's kind of a moving target, because when she says that she tried, what day? I mean, we have people working three shifts every day of the week, you know, different people on each every 8-hour shift. So we have different medical personnel, we have different deputies. The Wayne County Jail is the largest jail in Michigan County Jail by far. You know, so a lot of people.
Did you submit affidavits from any of those guards saying,
well,
she didn't make this complaint to us?
Well, no, we didn't, but the idea is that since I don't know what date range she said she did it, I don't, do I need to get 15 or 20?
I thought the day she came in, she said she got kicked. And theoretically, as soon as you get kicked as a pregnant woman, you complain right away.
Well, I mean, if
that's
it was
just a natural, to me, that's a natural inference.
Okay, well, but she doesn't say that. So even if that is the inference, right, then again, we'd have to go back to 2017 and find out who was working on that shift and who was on that unit, right? And I guess we could, you know, have that talk, and, you know, assuming all that. But I mean, like I said, it's, you know, the PLRA is sometimes can be very thing that's very easy for people to satisfy, because they can just say something general, but then we can't defend against it because there's not enough specifics, right? I tried to get hold of somebody after this incident. Okay, there were 30 different people who worked those 24-hour jets, including nurses and stuff, women, who did you talk to? What did they look like? What approximate time of day that is? And to say that, you know, it's just tough for us if you say that, well, you know, somebody would say that, okay, well, you need to find everybody on every ship and say, you know, I know who she was, and she didn't complain to me, didn't she complain to me? You know, and so, like I said, I think that at a certain point, the PLRA should require the plaintiffs to give some specificity if the argument is, I tried.
Well, if you think the statute should require something, this is the wrong place to come. Mm-hmm. And the other, your other complaint, I think it maybe is a fair one, is our case law is a little unfavorable to defendants, or to facilities in this area, but it is kind of our case law. So we're sort of stuck. We can't rewrite the statute. We can't overrule a prior panel.
Well, no, for sure. Judge, I agree. I mean, like I said, the difficulty we're having here is that Ms. Kupa changed factual positions on the issue, right? Judge Roberts says, I'm not going to create a question of fact. The last thing that you said was that you didn't file a grievance because you had a mental illness problem. That's the last thing you said on the issue. So I'm not going to say, revert back, like, well, your better argument was the argument you brought when Judge Tarnow had the case that you did it, you tried, right? And so from our perspective, it's like, we can't win this because, you know, if she can pick and choose which factual position she wants to take on appeal, then what are we supposed to say? Because if she says that, you know, I tried to file a grievance and nobody helped me, that would require a certain rebuttal proof. But if she says that I was my mental capacity was so impaired I couldn't file a grievance, those are two completely different cases. Right? So the first one is requires a factual resolution of the dispute. The second one requires the court to talk about whether there is a mental capacity exception to PLRA and what the extent of that would be. Right? So, like I said, it's almost like we have two different cases that are existing side by side based upon which version of the facts do you want to accept, you know, would be true for the purposes of the motion. Did she try to file and no one helped her? Or did she not file because of her mental health capacity issue? So, like I said, it's the court can obviously resolve this any way they want, but I'm just saying it's a little unfair for us in this case. There was no win.
There are, you know, the opposing counsel mentioned there were, four other circuits at least that say that courts can take into account mental capacity problems as to whether the PLRA grievance has, you know, is available to the inmates, right?
In terms of the mental health issue, Your Honor?
Yes.
Okay, so to me, if we were to go down this road, there's three approaches, I think, just the way I look at it. Like, you can have an approach that there is no mental health exception, right? So that might be the Williams versus White. It's like the Congress can write this in there. If Congress wants to accept certain inmates from this, let's see them put them in there, right? And then, you know, the second position could be what the plaintiffs are arguing is that, well, if I have a temporary disability and the jail has a time period, almost every prison and state facility has a time period. And if I'm in, you know, if I'm in isolation, if I broke my arm, if I have a mental health issue, if I can't do it within those 10 days, I never have to do it, right? So there's, you know, it's complete excusal if something was wrong, if you couldn't do something within the 10 days. I think that the Second and Fifth Circuit approach is the right one to take. It's actually the most humane, right? And the full spirit of both sides, right? That, you know, a jail, timeliness is not automatic. Jails can waive this offense. Right? So the jail is taking a risk when they say, I'm denying your grievance is untimely. Because now the inmate is exhausted, you know, and we can argue about these specifics later, right? So, you know, if an inmate has a disability and files a grievance 20 days late and says, sorry, I didn't file this earlier, but I couldn't, right? If the jail rejects that, or the jail or prison rejects that on the basis of timeliness, you've exhausted. We're done, right? And the jail could be wrong about this, but you could file your lawsuit, right? But I think that the approach is that you still have to require the inmate, once capacity is regained, to bring it up. Because if Ms. Kupa had not grieved, and then 2 or 3 months later says, well, you know, oh, I got to, you know, now I remember, I got to write this down. The Wayne County Jail could, I guess, reject it on timeliness grounds, or they could address it on the merits. And if there's a pitfall, you know, rejecting it for timeliness is actually a dangerous approach.
But the Wayne County Jail has nothing in its policy that allows you to file a grievance, does it?
Not explicitly, but in my experience, we almost never invoke the timeliness on it. You know, there's hundreds of grievances a month filed in Wayne County Jail, and I've almost never seen a timeliness. We try to resolve things on the merits.
Is there anything in the record that supports what you're saying, that is nothing's ever rejected based on time?
No, there is nothing in the record. It's just my, you know, just my experience with the grievance system means, you know, but like I said,
I didn't want to carry it very far, is it?
Well, I mean, the idea is that the Second and Fifth Circuit approach, the one that slices us down the middle, it says, look, you get, you know, if you have a problem with filing a grievance on time, you know, here, you know, you can file a late grievance, and your grievance isn't exhausted until the jail decides to reject that grievance because it's late, right? So now we have both sides. You know, you filed it late, you said I couldn't file it on time because I had a problem. The jail can accept that and deal with it on the merits, or they can, you know, reject it on the basis of timeliness. Either way, you fully exhaust it. But the idea is that we shouldn't have a system where, you know, just because an inmate might be temporarily incapacitated for within the time period, 10 days, 14 days, they are forever excused from raising that with the jail. I think that rule goes too far.
And it's helpful if the Wayne County Jail had a policy that says, you know, if you've got reason to believe that you were incapacitated or couldn't file within the 10 days, that you can file late, and we will consider whether it was good cause to excuse it. Of course, there is no such rule.
Your Honor, if I had known this case was coming, I would suggest that change. But I would imagine that no state correctional facility, you know, again, this pronouncement, and I feel like, you know, sort of alone in this, but, you know, any pronouncement on any exceptions to the PLRA don't just affect, you know, Wayne County, which is one of hundreds of counties in the Sixth Circuit. You know, we're talking about the Michigan Department of Corrections, you know, Ohio, Kentucky, Tennessee. You know, imagine that before we would make a big pronouncement on things, I would like to know what the people who run correctional facilities with thousands of people have to say about this, right? So, like I said, I just don't think this case is not the vehicle, I think, to make any bigger pronouncement on this issue. You know, I think that, you know, if we just stick to what was argued before the district court, right, and just look right in the briefing and deal with those arguments and deal how Judge Roberts resolved them.
Well, Roberts resolved it just by flatly saying there's no mental health exception to the PLRA.
Well, she also addressed the factual contentions on the merits, right? So, I mean, that was just kind of the final thing that she said, right? But, you know, the idea is that you first have to figure out what Ms. Coopwood's story is. Is it you grieve or did you not grieve, right? And so Judge Roberts took the second and final thing Ms. Coopwood said on the issue was that she didn't grieve, right? So which gets us into the legal, you know, purview as opposed to the factual one, which was Ms. Coopwood's original position. So, like I said, I don't think that this case presents the proper vehicle to make the grand legal sweeping argument or adopt a new rule. I think this case can be resolved on the narrower grounds. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Your Honor, just to respond to a few comments. Defendants argue that our argument has changed, and that's not so. Ms. Coopwood argued at length below, quote, that her mental and physical impairments rendered the jail's administrative remedies unavailable. And she relied on her affidavit, defendant's own submissions of the record, and referred to the existing record. Ms. Blackletter law that defendant's motion for summary judgment can be dismissed by their own submission of evidence. There is no rule saying that we can't rely on their evidence.
I thought their point was, she said she did file and she said she didn't file. And both can't be true.
Well, Your Honor, the Seventh Circuit in Smallwood found that the litigant there had intellectual disabilities, attempted to file, did so unsuccessfully, and was able there, the court, the Seventh Circuit, looked into the personal capabilities of that litigant and found that that was actually a relevant fact for showing that.
But that was a did file case or didn't file case?
Did file, 21 times before, attempted to file the grievance, unsuccessfully so. Again, here we
so
don't.
They did file. I mean, but factually, like, you either file or you don't. And right. That you're saying that was a case, that's not going to be a case where she didn't actually file, but the court said you did as a matter of law.
No, Your Honor, sorry. There in that case, the litigant did file, attempted to file, but unsuccessfully did so.
Well, attempted to file, but
well,
unsuccessfully.
It was not successful complaint and grievance.
So
and
did file. Yeah, and so under the policies here, the prison was required to help. As soon as your client complained, the prison was required to help her. So in that sense, that would probably count as a filing, but then they thwarted it by not reporting it and not doing anything.
Yes, Your Honor. This court, we can reach that second argument. We'd be happy with that ruling that she attempted to file and defendants not meet the burden. And here on, as well as below, defendants' argument that it was too tough for them to meet the burden. But that's the exact requirement that they must meet. They knew that they could interview a select number of guards within that 10 days, and it's their burden to
hear this. I just don't understand why you keep calling that your second argument. In other words, like constitutional avoidance, if we could decide something without reaching a constitutional question, we would. If we could decide your case without requiring a new interpretation of the statute, which arguably conflicts with prior unpublished cases in our circuit, why would we do that rather than if we could decide it on the more narrow ground under existing law, you win?
You certainly could do that, Your Honor.
But you just call it your second argument. It just feels to me like that's your first. And if we don't agree, then you should change the law.
I guess I'm just thinking about it in terms of how we organize it in the brief.
You took the higher mountain first, so I guess
yeah,
kudos
right.
to you guys.
That's right. We took the higher mountain first, and so that was the argument that took a lot more work to develop. But I mean, they both were substantive. I just want to address the this idea that there's a tolling exception.
Your time's up, but I took it, so go ahead, take 30 seconds.
Oh, thank you, Your Honor. No worries. The jail is bound by its own policy. They would not have accepted a late grievance at all. The Second and Fifth Circuit's cases did not turn only on that fact. And so they cannot now come and say that, oh, well, in hindsight, we would have accepted it. That is not relevant here. They bound by their own policies. With that, Your Honor, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.